Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Title to Compliance conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Robin Jones, Director of Great Lakes ADA Center. Ms. Jones, you may begin.
Thank you, and welcome to everyone. I hope everyone is enjoying the day after St. Paddy's Day across the country. I'd like to welcome all of our participants from each of the regions across the country. This is a collaborative effort of the Disability and Business Technical Assistance Centers, of which there are 10, all representing various regions of the United States and the various territories and areas of the United States. This is our March session for this year, the 2002-2003 calendar year of distance learning programs. This month, our topic is Achieving and Sustaining Accessible Programs, Strategies for State and Local Governments. For those of you joining us for the first time, we offer these sessions once a month on the third Tuesday of each month, and the sessions are 90 minutes in length. This session is being captioned real-time on the Internet. If you're interested in accessing that service and have not in the past, you can go to www.adagreatlakes, all one word, .org, and follow the links to the real-time captioning. The captioning is provided by Caption Colorado. A transcript of this session will be made available after the session and posted to our website, as well as a digital recording of the session for future reference. You can always go back and access any of the sessions that have been provided over the past 4 years from our website. At this time, I would also like to remind you that there will be a question and answer period. The speaker, Chris Palamas, will be indicating when he's ready to take questions, and the operator will come on the line and give you instructions on how to do so. So we ask you as we go along today, if you have questions, just jot them down, and as we get to the question and answer period, we will make every attempt to address each of your questions. As we go into the topic today, of which I said was achieving and sustaining accessible programs in state and local governments, one of the purposes or the reasons that we have this topic on our agenda this year is because of the number of questions that the Disability and Business Technical Assistance Centers receive from state and local governments as well as advocacy organizations about just what are the ongoing obligations of our Title II entities under the ADA and what can they do or should they be doing to ensure that they continue to address the needs of people with disabilities accessing their programs and services. There's been a lot of confusion regarding the various requirements under Title II of the ADA, confusion as they interplay with Section 504 requirements for government entities and such. And so we hope that today's session will give us an idea and some parameters of how to continue to address these issues and look at these issues across the board. As we know, the ADA is an ongoing obligation and not something that we just took a snapshot of back in 1992, made our changes, and hoped everything went along. Joining us today as our speaker is Chris Palamas, who is co-author of a document titled Title II Action Guide for State and Local Governments, which was originally produced in the early 90s by a grant from the NIDR, National Institute on Disability Rehabilitation and Research, which is part of the U.S. Department of Education. And it was, the main goal was to provide a blueprint or at least some parameters for Title II entities to go about producing and developing their Title II obligations under the ADA, such as their self-evaluation, as well as their transition plan. Chris is one of the main authors of that particular document. In addition, Chris is a principal in the Independent Living Resources, an organization located in Northampton, Massachusetts, which continues to provide consulting, training, and a number of services related to people with disabilities with a lot of expertise in the area of Title II entities. And Chris has been engaged in a number of activities both locally, regionally, and nationally in an ongoing effort to assist and identify where state and local government entities need to move forward in order to make sure that their programs are accessible to people with disabilities. At this time, I'm going to turn the program over to Chris, and he will be able to lead us through today's discussion. Hopefully, all of you have had opportunity to access the slides or the outline that Chris will be using. If you have not and you have access to the Internet right now, you can go online at, again, www.adagreatlakes.org. www.titletocompliance.org and follow the link to the schedule. And under today's session, March 18th, you'll find links to the PowerPoint slides, which are part of the outline that Chris will be using, as well as the supplemental materials of some sample checklists and documents that he provided us as part of today's session. So all of those are available online for both viewing as well as printable versions, and hopefully you'll have access to those. So Chris, at this time, I'll go ahead and turn over the microphone to you.
Thank you, Robin. This is my first experience doing training over the telephone. So it's going to feel a little peculiar to me just at the start, but I will get used to it. I should have tacked up pictures of a lot of folk in front of me and pretend it was my audience. But I do assume that you're all out there. What I would like to do is begin and give you a little bit about my background, just a couple of minutes, and then to review with you the scheme for Title II compliance that we laid out in the Title II Action Guide, relate that to some specific experiences of municipalities and state agencies, and see how to keep this as practical as possible over the next hour and a half. My own background is that back in the late 1970s and early 1980s, I was involved in starting a Center for Independent Living here in the western part of Massachusetts. And then in the mid-80s, I went into state government for 4 years. This was the time when Michael Dukakis was governor of Massachusetts, and we had very substantial state budgets at that time, and we were on a roll. It was eventually referred to as the Massachusetts miracle, somewhat speciously, but it was a time in which state government was able to accomplish much more readily than it is today for most of our states some of the ends of public policy. And during that time, we focused a good deal on our state response in terms of disability rights law. And some of that work a few years later then carried into some of the materials development processes for the federal government with the passage of the ADA in 1990 and the issuance of regulations in 1992. Essentially, we had had some opportunities to look at, for example, how to do large systems access assessment within state government, and that information and experience went into the formulation of the Title II Action Guide, amongst other documents. I left state government in 1988 and had the opportunity to do training with the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, with the Adaptive Environment Center, with the Association, American Association for Retired Persons, AARP, and others on ADA implementation, and also the experience of consulting with municipalities and state agencies. So that's why I get to say the things I'm going to say over the next hour and a half. Now, we will try to break this up so there are at least two opportunities for questions and answers. The first, I'm just going to go over the regulations just very, very quickly in a summary form, identifying also the distinctions between large and small municipalities. And I'm going to just try to make some points about what I've observed have been some of the key areas of misunderstanding that have led to weaknesses in the compliance process, and some of the areas in which there have been relative strength. I would assume that a fair number of you have taken a look at the ADA Title II Action Guide. And what the Action Guide did that was, I think, particularly useful was that it took all of the detail of Title II and it gave a kind of a scheme that was then applied to the practical process of implementation, planning, and development. We called the scheme that we presented in the Action Guide the 5-4-3 approach to ADA compliance. And by that, we meant that there were 5 administrative action steps that were required under the regulations. There were 4 principles of effective compliance that we derived from interviewing organizations that had either been particularly effective in their 504 compliance effort prior to the passage of the ADA, or organizations that had been gotten out quickly and effectively with the issuance of the Title II regulations and their compliance activities. And finally, there were three phases to the compliance process. And let me just quickly summarize those. The five administrative action steps were, first of all, and these apply to entities that had 50 or more employees. The first was to designate a responsible employee. The second one was to provide notice to the public of rights and protections under the ADA and how the entity met those obligations. And the third was to adopt a grievance procedure. Those I think of as table setting. Those were basic kind of foundation administrative pieces that led to the heart of the matter, which is requirement number four, which was the requirement to carry out a self-evaluation. And following from the self-evaluation, number five, was to develop a transition plan. Now, one of the most common weaknesses that we have found in the compliance process with Title II has been that self-evaluation processes, for the most part, have focused on one of the four areas predominantly, and that was program and facility accessibility, architectural accessibility, and have been less effective at addressing the other four areas of the self-evaluation. The four parts to the self-evaluation were, one, the obligation to provide equal employment opportunity. The second was to operate in a non-discriminatory way, to operate programs and services in a non-discriminatory way. The third area was to provide effective communication support for people with disabilities affecting communications. And the fourth part of the self-evaluation was to address program and facility accessibility. There are differences in the requirements that apply to smaller communities. I, at that time, was living in a town of about 1,600 or 1,800 people, and so was very aware of the difficulties that some of the smaller communities had in dealing with the complexity and scope of the Title II of the ADA. And what the ADA provided for, what Title II provided for, was that small communities could undertake a somewhat simplified process. And that simplified process was that with fewer than 50 employees, communities were not obligated to appoint a coordinator, were not obligated to develop a formal transition plan, were not obligated to adopt a formal grievance procedure, and were not obligated to maintain the self-evaluation on file for 3 years. So the differences are essentially differences of process and not of outcome. Even if smaller communities were not obligated to name a coordinator, to name somebody responsible for ADA compliance, they had to get the job done. So they didn't have to formally adopt a grievance procedure. They did have to respond to grievances and complaints, and it was in their interest to ensure that conflicts did not escalate to the point where they generated lawsuits or complaints to federal agencies. So smaller communities were acknowledged in the regulations in some ways that they would have some difficulty in dealing with the complexity of section of Title II of the ADA. But I'm not sure that the regulations really identified what were the key problems. We will return to those at some time. So the general scheme we're talking about, again, five administrative action steps, as I said, to name a responsible employee, to provide notice to the public, adopt a grievance procedure, and then to undertake a four-part self-evaluation. And the key weakness that occurred was that self-evaluations very often focused disproportionately on architectural accessibility. It was easier to deal with bricks and mortar, and very often the persons designated to comply were persons who were responsible for a physical plant in some way. But the other areas, employment, non-discriminatory operations, and the effective communications part of the self-evaluation tended to be neglected. Now, last year about a year and a half ago, we did a study for the state of Connecticut, their State Office of Protection and Advocacy, and we were looking at how 25 municipalities had done in complying with Title II of the ADA. And that close examination of 25 municipalities basically confirmed what I've already said. That is that self-evaluations disproportionately addressed architecture. Folks had a great deal of difficulty. To some extent, secondarily, after architecture, municipalities were able to come to grips to some extent with the basic employment obligations. But how to address non-discriminatory operations and how to address effective communication remained a point of weakness and confusion for a lot of those entities. Now, another weakness that we have seen has been the sort of misuse of the term transition plan. Under Title II of the ADA, transition plan was to grow out of the fourth part of the self-evaluation. That is, if in the self-evaluation, if you looked at buildings and facilities and found that some were not sufficiently accessible to support equal participation and benefit in programs, services, and activities, there were two ways of basically addressing barrier removal provided for in the regulations. And one was non-structural solutions like locating your programs in accessible space on an as-needed basis, moving programs into your accessible space, and also in some ways deploying staff or using technology to overcome barriers, a variety of non-structural means. And then the structural means of eliminating barriers were to carry out either modifications in existing space or to generate new space through new construction or additions. The transition plan under Title II was required of entities with 50 or more employees if structural means were necessary to remove barriers. Okay, if you had to carry out modifications or new construction. Generally, the term transition plan is used more broadly and colloquially. That is, any changes that result from the self-evaluation process were by many communities identified as the transition plan. And I don't think that's a major problem. It's a kind of a colloquial use of the term, but it is one that is not consistent, of course, with the legal and regulatory definition of terms within Title II. And that could reflect other areas of confusion, and that confusion generally was represented by other weaknesses in compliance. So it isn't the misuse of the term, it's that the misuse often reflected general problems in grasping the full scope of the Title II obligation. Okay? So that's our five administrative action steps. Now we got to four principles of effective compliance. As we were formulating the action guide, we talked to entities, state agencies, and municipalities, and other organizations that had addressed Section 504 effectively or had gotten out quickly in their Title II compliance process, and we found that there were four principles that seemed to result in stronger compliance efforts. And the first of those was getting commitment from senior entity leadership. One of the things that our coordinators often complain about is that they are sent out sometimes on detached service. That is, that they don't have the support of the senior elected or administrative leadership of the entity. They don't have open lines of communication. That senior leadership is not involved as they need it to be in carrying out and implementing the compliance planning process. So the first principle of effective compliance, commitment from senior leadership. The second principle was the coordination of compliance activities. As I said, there are four parts to the self-evaluation. Very often, a building inspector, a building official, somebody responsible for physical plant was designated to be the ADA coordinator. And if they looked carefully at the regulation, they would see that the scope of the self-evaluation was much broader. So broad, in fact, that it was very difficult for a single person to have command of all of the skills, all of the information, of the full range that would be required to effectively carry out the compliance process. So the idea of a coordinator, an ADA coordinator, it's a very good term because the responsibility when done effectively, in fact, was to coordinate, to pull a team together, to bring in the folks who were expert in employment or expert in program activities, to look for folks who had skills in the areas of communication, both electronic communications and computer applications, and to assemble a team to carry out the compliance process. So that was our second principle. The third principle was to creatively involve people with disabilities. The regulations did require that persons with disabilities, interested parties, and others had the opportunity to participate at least at the level of commenting on the planning process. But simply commenting at some point in the process did not equal effective compliance planning. The organizations that did well generally had established relationships with disability entities or individuals and found ways to involve them in the planning process to help them establish effectively priorities, to do very practical, at times, focus groups or roll-throughs of facilities, and in other ways to get directly involved in the compliance planning process so that that planning process was really responsive to the needs of people with disabilities and organizations representing people with disabilities. The fourth principle we wrote, and it's a little confusing, it was simply to institutionalize the compliance process, and that seems almost kind of a tautology in some way. Of course you have to institutionalize compliance if you're trying to go about really changing the way a public entity does business. But what this came down to, for the most part, institutionalizing compliance was directly related to the quality of skills and information that were cultivated among the people responsible for carrying out the compliance process, and that translated as quality training. Institutionalizing compliance, the number one element that was required to do it effectively was to find out who needed to know what, to bring them together, to give them the training and information and exposure that they needed to get the job done. So those are our four principles of effective compliance. We're going to revisit those in a while, you know, based on our 10 years of experience now, and see how that held up as we looked at those 25 communities in Connecticut. The last part of our 5-4-3 scheme were three phases to the compliance process, and those began with first planning and decision-making, carrying out the self-evaluation, developing the transition plan, collecting information effectively, making good decisions about priorities, good decisions about the phasing of compliance. The second phase of the compliance process was implementation. And the implementation process was defined in the regulations to have taken place over a period of about 3 years, but the simple fact of the matter is that for every public entity I've talked to, it's lasted a lot longer, and you could still say for many of you that you are in implementation phase, I would imagine. The third of the phases was follow-up and monitoring. If you carried out all of the modifications to policies and procedures that you felt were necessary, you instituted your new ways of doing business, and you also carried out those modifications to your physical plant, constructed new facilities where necessary or modified existing facility, it's still necessary to follow up and to monitor the outcomes. What's going on in the compliance process? And monitoring can vary. Certainly it ought to be done at least on a yearly basis, a six-month basis, or a yearly basis to ask yourself, how are we doing? What's going on? Now, what most organizations, in fact, what most public entities, in fact, have found out is that it has not been a continual, linear, consistent progression, that there have been ups and downs in the process, there have been changes in political environment, so that ADA coordinators often describe one of the major problems has been continuity from that senior leadership in their organization. There have been ups and downs of the budget process, and of course right now we're very aware that we are at one of the really down phases in terms of the budget process. But follow-up and monitoring is absolutely necessary to establish continuity in the process. Okay. Let's just stop here and take some questions. I mean, basically what I want to ask you all is the breadth of the scheme, the four parts to the self-evaluation, is that consistent with the way in which you, in fact, have operated? And then do you have any questions about that basic compliance scheme?
Thank you, Chris. We'll ask Paula to come in and give our participants some instructions on how they can get into the queue for questioning.
All right, thank you. If you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, if you have a question, press the 1 key.
First question, please.
Our first question is from Martha White.
Hi.
Go ahead, Martha.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Great. My question is, when you have a state government that reconfigures any particular department, how is the self-evaluation activity revisited? So, for example, if you combine agencies that conducted a self-evaluation, how is that self-evaluation then treated?
Okay, Chris, you want to take that?
Yeah, I don't think that is defined anywhere in the regulation. I think it's always a pragmatic response that you ought to look at the self-evaluation and do a quality review and see whether, in fact, it covers the scope. Now, one of the things that is I think, really key in the state agencies that, in my experience, have done a good job is that the self-evaluation leads to the definition of real working procedures, and those procedures are tied to access to specific resources. In other words, it's not just a paper process, but it's a matter of actually defining how you're going to respond to requests for effective communications support in a tangible way. And those responses to requests to support need to relate to knowing what your access lines are to secure the auxiliary aids and services that are either available within the system or where you have to go out of the system to secure them.
So, Chris, what you're saying then, in a case where you may have two agencies or three agencies that have combined together, all of which may have had their own policies and procedures in the past, the issue would be to go and look at those to see whether or not they're still applicable in this new environment, and then either identifying which were best practices and possibly putting those into place in the new or the reconfigured agency versus having to start over from scratch and start, you know, as a new entity.
Right. First of all, the question is, has the process been complete? And secondarily, is the process one that's really linked to, you know, real-world procedures and resources? Yes.
Martha, did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Rick Edwards.
Go ahead, Rick.
Hi, Robin. My question has to do with the transition plan and the self-evaluation itself. Since the mandate was just to do the transition plan, the self-evaluation, and all those other five parts that you were talking about, is there any requirement for following up with either updates or any changes that occur within programs?
No, there's not an obligation to get back and review and update. I think it's a matter of just applying good principles of public administration. You had an obligation to establish a grievance procedure to deal with any complaints, et cetera. So it's a matter, I think, of instituting. The organizations that have done well have basically gone beyond the letter of the regulation. and have instituted procedures for looking at what's going on ongoing. It's rarely been done every year in my experience, but there have been sort of key points at which something arises that refocuses attention back on the ADA, and organizations have looked back. In the Connecticut experience that we'll talk about, there a state agency, the State Office of Protection and Advocacy, took the initiative to look at 25, to create a sample of 25 municipalities to basically reflect back to them what the state of ADA compliance was. But that's not built into the regulation.
But it can be a tool. I mean, while it's not a legal obligation, the use of a self-evaluation as an ongoing tool for monitoring compliance could be something that people would find effective. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think if you don't monitor, you can't do effective compliance. It's as simple as that.
But Department of Justice wouldn't come in and ask you for your self-evaluation in year 2000, given that those requirements are not there anymore.
Well, they might. I spent this summer assisting a major urban school system in Connecticut resolve a civil rights complaint. It was actually through the Department of Education, which resulted from a complaint on behalf of a single student. But when the Office for Civil Rights of the Department of Education intervened, it asked to look, you know, broadly, more broadly, systemically at the system. And the system at first said, well, that was beyond the scope of the complaint, and the federal civil rights officials instituted a complaint which required a look at the entire self-evaluation and transition plan. In fact, had never been developed, or what had been developed was so inadequate that it was considered to be, the system as a whole was out of compliance.
So in a positive way, an entity could look at using their self-evaluation process as a piece of evidence of their ongoing compliance should issues arise down the road then.
Right.
Okay. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Twan Reynolds.
Yes. When it comes to regard to when you spoke about employment, in saying that in agencies and municipalities that a lot of the attitudes toward people with disabilities tends to come from the top, what would be some ways to change those attitudes and ways? Because as all of us know, the employment rate for people with disabilities is fairly high. What do you do in regard to change that, or to try to look at ways to improve on that?
That's a huge question. How do we go about changing fundamental attitudes?
Well, just the concept in the realm of employment.
In the realm of employment,
right.
Yeah. Well, you know, in my experience, what happens, change comes from champions within systems operating over time in creating real continuity in the change, and a relationship between these internal champions and external advocates that's really positive. I don't think there's any way that advocates simply coming from the outside can have leverage to really work on the culture of an organization. So our best experiences have been that very often they're called the ADA coordinator, but it's not only the ADA coordinator, but other folks, you know, within systems who tend to be, you know, knowledgeable, respected by their peers, who start building a base. And change, in my experience also, is never consistent. That is, certain agencies within a state system will tend to take the lead and perform most effectively. And then you have others starting to key on what the effective agency does and to some extent copying it. Sometimes you find the initial kind of leader is bypassed by someone else who starts doing a good job. In municipalities, they tend to be on a smaller scale, but there'll be a similar process. One place where we worked I guess it was around the mid-90s, a friend and I were called in to consult on the self-evaluation and transition plan of the city of New Britain, Connecticut, which is a city of about 85,000. And we were surprised that the ADA coordinator was the head of Parks and Recreation. And we thought, well, that's kind of a peculiar designation for the ADA coordinator, head of parks and recreation. We were a little concerned. The fellow turned out to be one of the outstanding ADA coordinators who we have ever worked with. And the keys to that were, first of all, his kind of motivation and concern around promoting integration of people with disabilities. He had done that in terms of employment in that several of his senior people were folks with disabilities. But he was also very respected within his system because he had been one of a number of reformers who had come in at a time of corruption scandals in the city. And a group of about five or six senior people came in. So he was able to perform well at a number of levels. He had done parks and rec programs where he had promoted people with disabilities into employment positions. They were doing outstanding work in their own programs. And then he had the respect of, the corporate council, and he had the respect of the personnel director and those long-term established relationships. So what he needed was from the outside, guidance on the detail of how to grasp the technical detail of Title II. He very much wanted a stronger community constituency, that is to have a commission on persons with disabilities meeting with them and pushing the city government. And that was how it built, was through real continuity of effort. Now, I can add to that awareness training, well-structured awareness training can be useful, can be very, very definitely useful. But training absent having some people to really kind of build your training effort around is going to be much weaker.
Okay. We know there are probably other questions, and we will have another opportunity for some more questions and answers, but this time I'll turn it back to Chris to continue with his presentation.
Okay. It's good to hear your voices out there. As I said, I was bouncing off my bulletin board here, and we will try to save a lot more time for questions and answers later. Let me talk a little bit about some of the projects I've done and then get into two areas. One was this Connecticut study that we did in 2002, and then also work with a state agency in Massachusetts just as examples of compliance process. Back in the early part of the decade, I got, as I was doing training actually with Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, and I think it was the winter of just after the regulations had been issued. I also, first training I did was actually in South Dakota, and my wife bought me some silk long johns to go to the cold north country of South Dakota. And to balance that out, I got a call from some folks who were doing compliance process with the Tampa International Airport, which had been considered by frequent traveler one of the outstanding, user-friendly airports in the country, and was an airport that was actually in the black. So I've got to join a team that worked at that municipal international airport. Short time after, I worked with New Britain, Connecticut, as I said. We worked with a number of other cities in Connecticut, Middletown and Bristol and some other cities in Connecticut. But we also started working with state agencies in Massachusetts. And one of the most important of those was the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. The Department of Public Health is an agency, and typical of many state agencies, the predominance of its services are provided under contract. That is, they had something like between 600 and 700 contracts with provider agencies, depending on how you count them. Now, that state agency had the difficult experience of having to resolve a complaint brought under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, and that was for discrimination in its program alcohol and drug detoxification services. And when the feds had intervened as a result of that systemic complaint, it had been a very painful, about 3-year process for that state agency to resolve the complaint to the satisfaction of the feds. And amongst the things that they learned from that process was when the feds intervened, they did so in a way in which the state agency lost a lot of its management discretion in how to go about the compliance process. That is that the feds wanted to negotiate a fairly aggressive regime of coming into compliance, and the state agency had lost a lot of the flexibility that was provided under Section 504 and under Title II. And that's one of the motivators that you can often describe. It's a reason for making sure that your compliance is up to date, is that you do not want to go through one of those federal complaints in the negotiated process, because you lose a lot of your prerogative as an administrator in doing that. Now, what that agency did in Massachusetts was to set up an ADA compliance project, as it was called, thereafter, to deal with all of its contracting agencies. And that's the material that we submitted for you all to download, were some of the materials that were used by the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, in which they basically asked their contracting agencies to go through essentially a self-evaluation process of their own and to submit the results to the contracting agency, the Department of Public Health. Now, the key to that was that the State Department of Public Health in Massachusetts was basing its action on its obligation to ensure that services provided under contract achieved the same level of compliance as if the state agency was doing it directly. In the compliance materials that we distributed, you will find that in some instances they exceed the requirements of the ADA. For example, while Title II is interpreted, I think, sometimes very weakly in terms of the extent of the obligation to provide direct access, communications access using TTYs, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health set its own standard and required all of its direct service provider agencies to have a TTY in place. And another area in which they exceeded the federal obligation, and one that I thought made good sense, was that they required that as part of the policies and procedures to be developed, that the contractor agency actually looked into its information and referral system and set up a process by which it defined its principal and primary referral tracks and gathered information to find out whether those agencies to which it might be referring clients were, in general terms, compliant with Americans with Disabilities Act. That is, whether there were some accessibility of facilities, whether those contracting agencies were aware of the obligation to provide effective communication support, to provide reasonable modifications to policies and procedures, to do the kind of problem solving that the ADA required. So that was one of the most successful efforts by a state agency that we had seen. We saw other effective efforts within specific agencies in Massachusetts. For example, the Division of Environmental Management instituted a program of promoting access in state parks and on state beaches. It hired a coordinator, a landscape architect who had a disability, and they wisely located the program out here in western Massachusetts, far from Boston, where it's hard to get anything accomplished, and did some very exemplary work in developing and testing designs and everything from access to boat docks, adaptive kayaking and rowing programs, and some others. So that's examples, again, of this kind of championing process. On the one hand, environmental management did it out of, I think, just purely having sort of the right people who had good motivation initiating that process to make state parks more accessible. On the part of the Department of Public Health, it was a matter of reacting to painful experience and saying we never want to go through that kind of compliance negotiation with a federal agency again. Okay, so that's a couple examples of state agencies. Now, about a year and a half ago, we were asked by the Connecticut Office of Protection and Advocacy to do a two-part study of Title II compliance with municipalities. And the first part was to review a whole mass of data. They had boxes full of survey responses to a rather poorly defined survey that had been sent out somewhat earlier to all of the municipalities in the state of Connecticut, and they asked us basically to summarize and see what we could get out of a review of that survey data. And then we were asked to visit 25 communities, to randomly select 25 communities and see how they were doing in terms of Title II compliance. And it turned out to be 27 site visits. That was because two of the communities actually had two principal buildings. And here's what we found by self-report in Connecticut. Reviewing the survey material that had been submitted, communities reported that is 84% of them said they had named an ADA coordinator. Very high number. About 71% said that they had issued some kind of a public notice. About 2 out of 3, 66%, said that they had adopted some kind of grievance procedure. The same proportion, 2 out of 3, 66%, said they had completed a self-evaluation. Only slightly more than half said that they had developed and completed a transition plan. But then it jumped up to, about 90% said that they held their public meetings in accessible locations, and 90% said that their cities and town halls were accessible. When we went out and visited and looked more closely, we found conditions to be somewhat different than that. Our findings on the 25 municipalities were, first of all, and we tried to interview the person who was the designated ADA coordinator. Whenever possible, that was the person we interviewed. And what we found was that those senior officials had a broad general understanding of the intent of the ADA, but they did not understand the details of it. And that relates specifically to what I said before about self-evaluations were heavily weighted towards facility accessibility. The other three parts of the self-evaluation, effective communications and non-discriminatory operations of programs and services, and employment obligations, were very weakly represented. Of those three, again, employment received more attention than others, but none of them received really detailed attention. To the surprise of advocates in Connecticut, we did find that the facility accessibility picture was somewhat better than I think significantly better than the advocates had thought that it would be in the state of Connecticut, but that the overall self-evaluation picture was weak. So self-evaluations and transitions plans were often incomplete, and also in many instances, while a paper exercise had completed a self-evaluation or a transition plan, and at some level had been carried out, very few implementation actions and very few systematic implementation actions had flowed from that. Transition planning and barrier removal were undercut by a lack of understanding of access codes and standards and insufficient skill in applying the principles of barrier-free design. That is that folks tended to focus on, you know, the most basic access elements. People understood the basic terms of an accessible route and a ramp, but they did not often understand the details of, how to really create a truly accessible an accessible restroom. They would miss details such as certain tripping hazards that might intervene in an accessible otherwise accessible route. And generally in the state of Connecticut, in contrast to Massachusetts, its neighboring state, what we found was that there were weaknesses in the design and construction industry and in facility management in terms of their understanding on access codes. And it we turned out that there was a historic reason for that. Massachusetts had developed rather early on a strong access code, and it had grown stronger over time, and it included a state access board with a fining power. That is, that there was real leverage behind state access standards and requirements so that when the federal obligations came in under Title II, there was a good foundation. In Connecticut, in contrast, where there was not a strong foundation in state access enforcement, you looked at the Connecticut statute and there was simply no consequence to a lack of compliance with the state standard. Once the ADA came into effect, the state was much more challenged. People in both the public and the private sector were working much harder to develop those skills and understanding of what was going on in access codes. Okay. Additional findings. Let's see. Some of the people we spoke with flat out acknowledged that they just didn't understand the ADA process or outcomes in their community. Very often, because there was a survey, somebody got designated that late as the ADA coordinator, and they simply acknowledged they really didn't know what it was about, and there was no record, the self-evaluation or transition plan, if there had ever been one. The record was lost, and they couldn't say what had happened. Another finding was that the burden tended to fall on individuals with disabilities to initiate requests for communication support or modifications to policies and procedures. Folks with disabilities generally had to be aggressive in defining what their needs were and making the requests, rather than the city and towns fulfilling the intent of the public notice requirement in actively providing that information to people with disabilities. Furthermore, when somebody initiated a request, for a lot of communities, it was a matter of like reinventing the wheel. Oh my God, I've been asked to provide an augmentative communication system. How do I do that? There were not, you know, in place the kind of procedures linked to resources that would have facilitated that process. Finally, there was little participation by individuals with disabilities in the self-evaluation process, despite the existence of a fair number of commissions on people with disabilities. So if you compared what was going on in Connecticut to the principles of the action guide, there wasn't a very good match. Folks would say, you know, one of the problems, again, here is as the ADA coordinator, a lot of the time I just feel like I'm on detached service. They tell me to do the job. I don't have any consistent leverage or authority to get the job done. The changes in administrations, you know, I might get at one point in time a mayor or a council that's supportive, and at another time I lose that support. I might establish some accessible parking spaces, for example, at this very limited parking area at the rear of a major urban city hall, and then the next administration comes along and those spaces are taken to for the use of political appointees. Okay. Now, specifically on physical access, what we found were, looking at some of the key features, we looked at 37 exterior access routes. That is, there were 27 buildings and there were 37 major exterior access routes. Of those, about 15 were pretty accessible, but 18 of them had major deficiencies, that is, tripping hazards, seriously deteriorated ramp surfaces, ramps that were too steep, no handrails or only a single handrail, insufficient maneuver space, a lot of other problems. There were about 4 of those 37 routes that had more minor problems. Going into the buildings, there were in the 27 buildings, 8 of the 27 had at least one fully accessible unisex restroom or a pair of men's and women's accessible restrooms. In other words, we did somewhat better on access routes to get to the building, and then only 8 out of 27 had anything we would call a fully accessible restroom, at least one of them. 7 buildings had major barriers in the restrooms, such as narrow doors, inadequate turning. About 12 buildings had more minor barriers. And it goes on that way. Most of the buildings had some kind of accessible parking spaces, but only 7 had at least one van accessible space. a big roll-off with assistive listening systems. We only found three of these major town buildings that had some kind of hard wiring for listening systems or wiring to support portable. We found very limited, again, very limited signage, braille and tactile signage. Okay. Let's stop again and take some more questions.
Okay, Paula, if you'd give instructions again, please.
All right, thank you. If you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. Again, if your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, press the pound key. If you have questions, press the 1 key.
First question, please.
Our first question is from Pam Guy.
Go ahead, Pam.
We are working with a school district right now and in finishing their transition plan. And one of the problems we're having as we see it is that their timelines are 6 and 7 years down the road. And we wondered if there's any policy on doing a new transition plan every 3 years and if that would have any effect on the 6 and 7 year timelines for accomplishing the transition to compliance.
Again, you go back to the original requirement that the transition plan was to have been formulated within 6 months of the issuance of the regulations and then executed from the issuance of the regulation 3 years or 2.5 years after. Now, most systems simply haven't done that. Most of the Title II entities have not accomplished that. So there is no formulation of additional transition plans. What they are doing is going back and meeting their original obligation to achieve program accessibility, that is to look at the system as a whole and accomplish a sufficient level of accessibility within the system as a whole. So one of the difficult things when you're explaining the Title II obligation is, on the one hand, acknowledging that folks are very often out of compliance, that is that they have, you know, legal exposures and ongoing liabilities on account of their noncompliance, and then getting them to move forward as expeditiously as possible. The system that we worked with this summer was in a very, very poor city, and a city was faced with the prospect now of, to some extent, playing catch-up because of a federal complaint, and they had to move rather quickly to a certain level of compliance and then carry out additional compliance over a longer period. And what we found in this instance was, again, it was a good progressive reform administration that was coming in to fix a system that was largely broken, was that the plan that they adopted actually exceeded what the feds required for a, you know, program access solution. But what the feds did require was that they get to the baseline of ADA compliance as quickly as their resources would enable them to do, and that was within a period of about a year, year and a half. And they would then extend their additional goals for bringing additional schools up to grade, et cetera, that they would take additional time on that.
Yeah, how do I respond to that?
So, I mean, that's something that would be, as the person asking the question, of something that would be 6 to 7 years out, I mean, obviously it would have to be looked at as why is that 6 to 7 years, and what are they doing in the meantime to ensure that those individuals have access during that period of time, if it's even necessary for that 6 to 7 years. I mean, spreading it out as long as possible when it's been in place since 1992 for the majority of the provisions doesn't seem very reasonable, to say another 6 years. To get into compliance, or at least minimum level compliance, from what I'm hearing.
Yeah, and systems have put themselves in a difficult spot in terms of claiming, you know, any undue burden exemption because of the delay.
Any other question, or is that? Do you have any follow up to that from the site?
Yeah. Why don't we have some follow up?
Go ahead, Earl.
Well, you answered my question quite well. They have neglected the whole process since 1990 or 92, and now they're in the process of trying to catch up. But there's still using lack of money as an excuse. And they are opening themselves up to legal procedures.
Absolutely.
Yeah, even having the transition plan is not going to protect them, I mean, from the fact that they haven't done anything or have failed to do anything for the last, 10 years.
Well, I think that's a good point. I think that the attitude I hear is now that they have a transition plan, they're fairly well protected. And that's not true.
It is not true. It's not true. They may have a transition plan, but they have not implemented it. And again, the key in this system that I worked with last summer was that there was a well-timed and very powerful complaint was brought, and it was a complaint that was based on a single student with a disability. When the Department of Education Office for Civil Rights intervened, they then broadened the scope of that complaint and forced the whole system to move. The advantage in that instance was that, in fact, there were some administrators there who were very willing to use that leverage and could see how ADA compliance fit into their whole agenda for strengthening public education in the city. And that was very helpful, not breaking out the disability issues and arguing that this is draining our essential purpose, but rather saying it was an important part of the whole effort to systemically strengthen public education in that city.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question is from Michael Fletcher.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, this is Mark Bledsoe. I had two questions. One, if I understand this correctly, any municipality or governmental agency which contracts for services, those specific services that are contracted also have to be compliant with your current transition plan and self-evaluation plan. Is that correct?
The requirement in the regulation is that when services are provided under contract, they have to, I don't remember the specific language, but essentially we used to say that the contractor agency stands in the shoes of the public entity. That is, they have to achieve the same level of compliance as if the public entity were providing the service directly.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. You cannot move to a lower level of ADA compliance by saying, gee, this is just a poor nonprofit organization, and after all, they can't meet that effective communication obligation because it really is an undue burden for them, or more quickly becomes an undue burden. Now, the difficulty in terms of the advocacy issue is that it is that the state's obligation still to hold its contractors to that level, and since the state is the source of funding, the tricky advocacy issue is to get the state to ante up and not just pass this on to its nonprofit service providers, but to get the state to do realistic budgeting. And because sometimes the level of demand, let's say for sign language interpreter services, over the state of Massachusetts with 700 agencies providing services under the Department of Public Health, there is no way in which you can project across those 700 agencies exactly what the level of demand for sign language interpreters is going to be by agency. So there also was important to get a kind of interaction where the state developed some flexible procedures so that the nonprofit would be paying for the interpretive services out of its base budget up to a certain level. And then if that became really burdensome, before they were denying services to anyone, they would return and go back to the state agency and say, here we have this greater demand, and the state agency had a flexible budgeting mechanism to respond to that. Now, again, none of this is required in regulation in terms of the detail of that kind of interaction. It's the general term of the contractor agency having to provide the same level. And then it is up to folks, using the best principles of public administration that they can develop to find ways of making that work.
And also just to follow up, it's also their responsibility to make sure from the state agency or the city or whatever governmental agency to make sure that they monitor their contractors for compliance.
Absolutely.
That's often overlooked.
And the second question was, if it's been some time since, for example, a local self-evaluation and transition plan was revised or updated, and new programs have come into play from new funding sources, are those programs, services, and funding sources obligated to comply with the ADA regulations?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the purpose of the self-evaluation and transition plan was to get to a level of compliance that's then going to be institutionalized, and anything that then, any new program that comes into effect comes under that same umbrella of compliance obligations. And again, the Massachusetts, some of those materials from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health addressed, I think, for example, in the area of eligibility requirements, that any new programs developed, I think it said in the examples that we laid out there, any new programs instituted or developed would also be reviewed to come under the same. But it wasn't limited to their eligibility requirements. They came under the same umbrella in terms of the whole scope of their whole scope of their obligation.
Okay. Thank you.
Next question, please.
Our next question is from Christy Mattel.
Go ahead, Christy.
Okay. This is Bob Siegelman. Even though I'm in California, I've received copies of a couple of letters from consumers in Connecticut who are having trouble, getting the Connecticut Public Utilities Commission to establish an education program for speech to speech, which is part of the relay system. Can you suggest a Connecticut advocacy agency who might be willing to intercede to get the Connecticut PUC to establish such a program? Go ahead.
Yeah, there are two that I can think of most immediately, and those are the state agency is the Connecticut Office of Protection and Advocacy for Persons with Disabilities, and the assistant director there is Stan Kozlowski, K-O-S-L-O-S-K-I, and I'm seeing if I can quickly come up with his number. The other that I would suggest is the ADA Coalition of Connecticut. And the ADA Coalition of Connecticut, their coordinator is Ilana Sherman, and her number is 860-297-4383. And Alana should be able to connect them with other advocates and networks.
Okay, Chris, we'll go have you go back on to your presentation. We'll still allow some time for some additional questions here at the end.
Okay.
So,
okay. Now, the Connecticut process, I just want to finish up a little more here with we asked the ADA coordinators what they wanted. One of the outcomes of that process was that we really did see that the ADA coordinators, while not every ADA coordinator was a champion, as we would call them, a lot of them were. And there were many who might have been less experienced but were still motivated to learn and to strengthen what they were doing. So at least in terms of municipal compliance, what the ADA coordinators in Connecticut said they wanted were, first of all, additional training, and that ranged from basic to advanced ADA skills, and with the greatest emphasis on facility accessibility and on employment. Again, on facility accessibility, what we found was that in Connecticut, there was less knowledge of the details of access codes and how to really apply it thoroughly, and they recognized that. And they also were very interested in employment. The heart of the employment obligation is the obligation to provide reasonable employment accommodations, but there were other areas that were of great concern. How to understand how to basically put in place assurances that when interviews were taking place, that the interviewers would ask only permissible questions and would avoid those that were impermissible. That is, the ADA allows some things to be asked and precludes others. And the greatest problem municipalities identified was very often there were volunteer or elected officials who were very undisciplined, who might participate in employment interviews and could ask some pretty damn stupid things that could immediately raise problems of discrimination in terms of the implication of the question. So the first thing they asked for was training and a program of training that would be flexible between basic to more advanced ADA skills. The second thing the coordinators wanted were opportunity to discuss common concerns with other coordinators. They basically wanted the opportunity to talk to one another and to get mutual support and some mentoring to exchange ideas and information. They wanted to strengthen their own network, and with further discussion, many of them felt that that would best be done on a regional basis rather than trying to do it as the whole state, but to start with a regional structure of motivated coordinators talking with each other, meeting with each other, and sharing information. The third was they wanted examples and models of proven procedures and policies that can easily be put into place. That's why I included that that set of materials from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, because those were models of proven procedures and policies. That is stuff that was, you know, relatively off the shelf, things that could be shaped to the particular style or needs of a particular municipality or particular agency. But, boy, it's very helpful to have something to adopt. And, again, those examples that we gave are very tangible. They get down to saying, you know, who is responsible? Who makes a request of this individual? Within what amount of time will that request be responded to? Who has the responsibility, for example, generating alternative to print formats? To really get that stuff down in detail. And what we had suggested to organizations was putting down that kind of very, very detailed information into some kind of a compliance manual that you have on the shelf, so that if nobody makes that request for a particular, let's say, alternative to print format over a year and a half, and by the time that request comes in, it's another person who's designated with a responsibility, that new person can still know, well, here's my guidebook, and I can get this down and open it up, and it will say, oh, these are my sources for having, you know, Braille done within the state of Connecticut, or here are sources for long audio tapes, and they have this very specific and tangible stuff on the shelf. Coordinators very much wanted that. They wanted information in areas like effective communication. This is sort of a repetition of what I just said. What to get, where to get it, how much it costs, how much time it takes. Very down-to-earth information. Coordination they asked for with state authorities, and they wanted priority from state authorities to give priority to capital expenditures that support ADA compliance and expand services to all citizens. Very often municipal capital expenditures were subject to various levels of state approval, and sometimes the state level was working at cross purposes with the local approval. That advocates had, internal and external advocates had managed to raise ADA compliance to a high level at the municipal level, and then they send their requests on to the state and found that the state approving bodies were working on a different level. They recommended the creation of a statewide association of coordinators. They recommended that a program of training be developed. They recommended that the state of Connecticut develop a state regulatory mechanism to ensure consistent enforcement of state architectural accessibility standards. I think that's an important one that, again, looking at Massachusetts' experience, that Massachusetts' comparatively strong performance in the areas of barrier-free and universal design, the key to it was that there was a state enforcement mechanism, very strong in Massachusetts, including a fining power, but also a mechanism that would enable folks to take a request for a waiver if somebody felt that, boy, I really do have a very difficult technical problem here in accomplishing, fulfilling certain details of my access code, that it was very useful to be able to go and discuss those technical issues with knowledgeable persons, and that it was extremely cumbersome to rely on communications with the Federal Access Board or with the Department of Justice to do that. So that was one of the primary things on their long-range agenda, was to create a state regulatory system. The next was to encourage state funding, as I mentioned, to support their capital priorities. They wanted a comprehensive guide to effective communications, resources, and services in the state. So here were the municipalities saying, we want a state agency, like the Office of Protection Advocacy, take the lead, pull together a comprehensive guide on effective communications resources, and disseminate it. They wanted a library of ADA resources, including model policies and procedures, the kind of thing I gave you one example of. They would like to see as many of those as possible collected. And the ideal would have been to have them, of course, accessible on the web, but otherwise readily accessible. They wanted examples of self-evaluations and transition plans. They wanted to look at, for example, the city of New Britain, which was known to have done a good job. Could I see what their self-evaluation looked like? Could I see their transition plan, see the format, see the correspondence that followed up to document whether compliance was taking place? They wanted stronger involvement of individuals and organizations, people with disabilities. They wanted to basically bring them into gaining leverage on getting their sometimes their senior leadership to agree to review and do a quality review of their ADA compliance to see where they were at. Okay, so we come to reviewing, going back to those initial keys that we had to effective ADA compliance, and they hold up pretty well. The revised, as we came to the end of that study that we looked at, were first of all to identify and support champions, that is to find those people within the systems who are the people who are really promoting ADA, and to look about ways in which to collaborate with them, to support them, and to strengthen them. Sometimes that's political and sometimes it's practical. Ensuring continuity of effort is a matter of, very often it's for the advocates, not to lapse in terms of maintaining the dialogue around these issues. When a new administration comes into place, reopen the dialogue. Strengthening advocate skills, again through training, again through promoting dialogue between internal and external advocates. Cultivating the press and public awareness. A lot of the continuity of the ADA effort is, what's the fashionable issue today? Finding opportunities to get the press to return to attention to the ADA. At a time when we have lots of budget cuts and the crises that are occurring in almost every state in the nation right now because of cut of public budgets, you can find that your press is going to be willing to go back very often to look at documenting some of the ways in which people with disabilities are being affected and to actually link that to ADA. There is a time for strategic complaints and lawsuits. There's no question about it. Strengthening state and local compliance resources, that's like the Access Board that I mentioned. And finally, the key of including agencies that provide services under contract as well as the state agencies themselves. Let's spend our last 10 minutes or so again with questions. I'm amazed at how an hour and a half flies.
Great. Paula, can you please give instructions again just so we can get some more folks who might have questions?
Thank you. Again, if you have a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone.
First question, please.
I'm showing a question from Martha White.
Go ahead, Martha.
Hi. I was going to ask, in a secure, locked setting, then how do we address the ADA issue for accommodation of wheelchairs and such? If we have a mental health facility, for example, where we're required to lock certain patient units, is there a requirement for us to have accessible doors, or do we just have to ensure that they're wide enough and that someone's available to escort the patient or the chair out?
I'm not sure I understood all of that question. The locked facility, like all others, comes under the requirement, the transition planning requirement, to create accessible facilities.
Okay, I'm not asking that. We have, say, doorways are wide enough. The patients really aren't as free to come and go as they would be in, say, a regular hospital.
Yes.
And therefore, is there a requirement, like we have automatic doors to the administrative building, but we wouldn't on individual units based on the requirement to have security locks. And so the doors are different. Is there some other type of accessibility standard that we must meet when we're talking about those doors?
If the basic dimensions of the door is compliant and hardware, latch side clearance, et cetera,
yes.
Then you're in compliance. There's no requirement to maintain unlocked a door that otherwise would be locked. If that locking of the door is part of the, is part of the program and necessary to operation of the program. You don't have to operate it in a different way for people with disabilities. You do have to have a facility that and lets the folks who might be using wheelchairs or have other needs that relate to access features, they have to be enabled to participate in the same way that others do and to benefit at an equivalent level.
Okay, thank you.
I think there's often confusion that electric doors are required under the ADA, and while electric doors are a means or method of providing access, they're not a specific requirement. You always would go back to the program and the service and what you're actually trying to achieve to make sure it's equivalent. Next question, please.
Our next question is from David Cameron.
Go ahead. Hello?
Can you hear us?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, Lynn will ask the question.
This is Lynn Geiser, and I would like to know if you have any experience with retirement systems being able to make sure that their programs and their interpretations are equal and fair to the disabled person.
I don't have any specific experience of it, but one of the things that very clearly has to be explained under the employment provisions is that the reasonable accommodation requirement extends to all, you know, of the benefits of employment, including retirement.
There's also a very good guidance on retirement systems and retirement programs that the EEOC offers on their website under their guidance area that talks about those programs and the obligations of entities to ensure that the benefits are not operated in a discriminatory manner in any way, shape, or form that might be useful to you as well.
Is that all I need is to go to EEOC and look under guidelines?
Actually, you would go to EEOC.gov.
Yes.
And then on their left-hand side of their page, there's a section that says Rules, Guidances, and Regulations.
Yes.
You would click on that, and then there's another link for enforcement guidance.
Okay, thank you.
And then under there, you would look for the guidance on retirement program.
Okay, I have another.
We're going to move on. Unfortunately, our time is getting short, so if we get a chance, we'll come back to you. Okay, next question, please.
Our next question is from Pam Guy.
Go ahead, Pam. Hello?
It looks like she disconnected.
All right, next question.
Next question is from Jamie McCarville.
Go ahead, Jamie.
Hello. I just wanted to say thank you so much for the program today. I have gotten a number of ideas to take back to the Wisconsin Partnership.
Great.
And I also wanted to ask specifically if Chris has had any experience with substance abuse programs and guidelines specifically for that, or know of someone in the country that's working specifically with substance abuse programs.
Yeah, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health program that I mm-hmm. mentioned was initiated because of a complaint against its substance abuse program.
Oh, okay.
Under Section 504. And so they have a tremendous amount of experience there. I would suggest, while that agency is in chaos, I'd suggest that you try to reach Paul Tupper.
Okay.
T-U-P-P-E-R. At the Massachusetts Department of Public Health.
Great.
They're at 250 Washington Street in Boston.
250 Washington. Thank you so much.
Good luck.
Well, we're wrapping up. We're at the end of our hour. It's approximately 2:28 Central Time, so we're kind of needing to wrap up at this time. I'm sure there are many other people who have questions. As any a topic like this does generate a great deal of discussion and questions, and oftentimes there's more questions than answers, but I think it's good that we do have this dialogue and continue to have this dialogue. This is, as I said, one of several sessions offered each year by the DBTACS nationally, Disability Business Technical Assistance Centers, to try to increase opportunities for people to dialogue around a variety of issues on the ADA. If you have questions that we were unable to get to today, I would recommend that you contact your Regional Disability Business Technical Assistance Center, which you can do by calling them at 800-949-4232. If you'd like to locate the one that's nearest you, if you're not familiar with it, you can also go to the website of www.adata.org, where there's a map on there that you could identify which state you're in and then which regional Disability Business Technical Assistance Center would be able to serve you. Again, as I mentioned earlier, a transcript of this session will be available in the next week or so on our website at www.adagreatlakesalloneword.org, as well as a digital recording of this session if you'd like to re-listen to it, again, at your own convenience. We do want to thank Chris for his time today. We want to thank each and every one of you for joining us. Again, all of the Regional Disability and Business Technical Assistance Centers appreciate your participation. We welcome you to join our session next month in April, which will focus on employment and reasonable accommodation, and it will be looking at the whole issues of reasonable accommodation, going back to the basics, kind of reexamining, making sure that we're all still looking at reasonable accommodation in the manner that it was intended, and explore some of the activities that have taken place since implementation of the ADA as it relates to reasonable accommodation. So I invite you to join us. If you'd like more information on that session, you can get that information either from your Regional Disability Business Technical Assistance Center or off of the Great Lakes website, as I indicated earlier. Again, thank you one and all for your joining us today, and I hope you have a very good day. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Robin.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time, and have a good day.